Important to point out that Amy, it isn't tens of thousands of Israelis who've gone out to the street, it's hundreds of thousands. To make that equivalent in the United States, it would be like 25 million Americans taking to the streets. That's the dimension of the protests that we've seen in the last days since the bodies of those six hostages were recovered. We could get many more Israelis on the street if they believed that the Hamas was really willing to release all the hostages, which is why I've pleaded with the Hamas to say yes, not only to me, but to tell the Egyptians and the Qataris that they agree to the deal that I proposed to them, which is a three-week end of war, full-term ceasefire, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, release of all the Israeli hostages, and a release of an agreed number and list of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. This is a deal that can be made. It is a million times better than the deal that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate unsuccessfully for the last 3 months, which would just keep the war going and only release 32 hostages in 42 days. That's a bad deal. We need to have a good deal put on the table. I've communicated this to the White House, to the Qataris, to the Egyptians, and of course to the Israeli government. Now the officials need to push this through.
Why is Netanyahu refusing?
Well, it's very clear that Netanyahu doesn't want to end the war, as one of his top negotiators told me on Saturday. The problem with any agreement that we can put forward is that the bottom line is that Hamas won't make an agreement that doesn't end the war, and Netanyahu won't agree to any agreement that ends the war. He wants to keep this going. He certainly won't consider ending the war until they find and kill Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader in Gaza. But I think that the message of this past weekend was that there's no reason to believe that any hostage will survive if Israel, in fact, does find and kill Yahya Sinwar. There's no reason to believe that they won't simply execute all the remaining hostages.
Can you talk about the state of the negotiations since, it's widely believed that it was Israel who assassinated Ismail Haniyeh, the lead negotiator, on inauguration day of the new president in Iran. The significance of this?
I'm not sure that it had a real impact on the negotiations. Haniyeh was the face of the negotiators from Hamas with the Qatari prime minister, but he wasn't actually a member of the negotiating team. He wasn't in the room when negotiations were taking place. Of course, he was the leader of the Hamas Politburo and played a significant role there. There are debates of whether or not he was pushing for an agreement or pushing against an agreement. It doesn't really matter at this time. He's no longer there, and there are other leaders of Hamas right now. Hamas makes decisions generally in consultation, and they try to reach consensus. When there is consensus or when there is a decision, it's announced by the Hamas leader in Beirut, Osama Hamdan. And when Osama Hamdan says something in a press conference or on his Telegram page, it's official, and everyone in Hamas stands behind it. That's what we're waiting for now. That's what I'm waiting for now, to Hamas to say that we agree to a three-week deal that will end the war, will release the hostages and release Palestinian prisoners, of course, increase humanitarian aid into Gaza in a really substantial way. That has to be part of the agreement as well. But we really need Hamas to signal to the Israeli public that this kind of deal is on the table so that we can mass the public in the numbers way above a million people on the streets to force Netanyahu to accept it.
It keeps being said that he wants to keep Israeli soldiers in the Philadelphia corridor. I spoke to Gideon Levy yesterday on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and he said it's not even worth talking about this. No one even knew what this was months ago. Suddenly it has become so key. What is your assessment of what Netanyahu wants there and why this has become important?
Look, last night on one of the main Israeli television stations, Alon Ben-David, a very significant military correspondent, said that in all the past months that the Israelis are searching for tunnels that lead underneath the Philadelphia corridor, the borderline, 14-kilometer borderline between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, they haven't found a single tunnel that penetrates the border. We have to recognize that this is an international border. There is a sovereign Egyptian side of the border. The Egyptians are responsible for sealing that border. And I'm certain that with the request from the United States and Israel, the Egyptians would agree to American finance and technology know-how and American supervision observers on the ground to ensure that the border is closed. This is a made-up issue by Netanyahu to create a new, I don't know what we want to call it, a new excuse for Israel to remain in Gaza. Essentially, at the bottom, at the end of the day, what it means is that Israeli soldiers would be sitting ducks along the line of this border where insurgents from Hamas would be able to kill them. And that's what we're facing today. Hamas has been largely decimated in terms of its military power, but they have the ability to engage in armed insurgency and kill Israeli soldiers every single day. Hamas fighters popping out of a tunnel and shooting an RPG at an Israeli tank or an Israeli vehicle. And we should be reminded of 18 years of Israel sitting in southern Lebanon where soldiers came home every week dead as well. That should be a lesson for us.
Can you talk about what happened back when you were involved with the negotiation to release the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners? And do you take any lessons from then to what's happening today?
It's a very different situation when we're talking about over 100 hostages in an active war that's been fought for 11 months with the total destruction of Gaza and 40 to 50,000 Palestinians killed and 1,700 Israelis killed or more than that so far. So it's really different. But there are some lessons. One is that there's no replacement to a direct secret back channel with direct communication between the parties. Even if it's not an official channel, it's a way to deliver messages and to brainstorm and find new ideas. There's no doubt that negotiating through third-party mediators like Qatar and the United States and Egypt convolutes the situation, makes it much more complex, and each side has its own interest here. There's great reluctance to make compromises. What I've seen, what I've observed over the last 18 years that I've been doing these negotiations is that sometimes it's just unbelievable the kind of behavior of the people in charge of these negotiations, who sometimes seem to be as if they're in a kindergarten classroom, with bringing up issues and ways of talking to each other or talking at each other that resemble what young children would do, rather than being responsible and finding direct ways to resolve the problem, which is ending the war and getting the hostages home. They never deal with it directly. And this is the truth today as it was many years ago when Gilad Shalit was in captivity.
What do you think it would take at this point in this last minute we have, Gershon?
I think it would take a Hamas acknowledgement that they're ready to release all the hostages so that we can mobilize the Israeli streets. And it will take extreme American pressure on Netanyahu to make a deal. And the Americans have the pressure if they were to choose to use it.
And what would that look like, the U.S. putting pressure on Israel?
Well, look, the most obvious are the two things that they are the most powerful. One is the shipment of arms to Israel, which is unlikely to happen. The other is the use of the veto in the Security Council and other international arena. But the American-Israel relationship is so deep and so wide that there are many ways that the United States can use soft power with Israel to get the message across. And what's important is that it's not done just to Prime Minister Netanyahu, but that the Israeli public knows what the United States of America wants and what it's demanding from Israel. Again, we are still a democracy, or what's left of a democracy, and the people are the sovereign, and we can mobilize the people if we have the tools to do that.
Biden, what is the single most important thing he can do as president of the United States?
To put a deal on the table, which is a good deal, the kind of deal I talked about, and to let the Israeli public know that it's there. The United States is backing it, Qatar is backing it, Egypt and Hamas will support it. That's the most important thing that Biden can do right now.
Gershon Vasker, I want to thank you for being with us. Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization, longtime back channel negotiator with Hamas. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. When we come back, Dynamite Nashville. Back in 20 seconds.
I'm home.
morning, Sam and Dave. Written by Isaac Hayes, a Georgia judge has agreed with a lawsuit by the Hayes family that said the legendary singer would disapprove of Donald Trump's campaign's use of his song and ordered the campaign to stop playing it at rallies. The Trump campaign, that is. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Nashville, Tennessee, where the mayor recently introduced four new measures that attempt to protect free speech rights while also addressing what some call the city's Nazi problem. Nashville Mayor Freddie O'Connell also announced in July he's reopening a police investigation into three unsolved bombings in Nashville from the civil rights era. This all comes after Nashville journalist Betsy Phillips published a new book into the attacks titled Dynamite Nashville, Unmasking the FBI, the KKK, and the Bombers Beyond Their Control. In her book, Phillips writes, quote, just as Nashville was where civil rights icons like John Lewis, James Lawson, and Diane Nash began, Nashville's also where a network of racial terrorists began, unquote. Around the same time the book just came out, neo-Nazis marched through Nashville's downtown for the third time this year. Many carried U.S. and Confederate flags. A viral video shows them yelling racist slurs at a group of black children. After the attack, the children and their parents spoke out. This is 10-year-old Detonio Wilson and his mother sharing the advice she gave him.
I feel like it was racist because they were just saying bad words to us, and the police didn't do nothing. They were just telling us to go home.
Don't leave it stuck in the back of your minds like that, because it will mess you up tremendously, yes, like for a long time.
For more on this, I spoke with Betsy Phillips about her new book, Dynamite Nashville, for which she spent nearly a decade trying to uncover the truth about the three civil rights era bombings in Nashville that all went unsolved. The Hattie Cotton School in 57, as it was set to integrate. The Nashville Jewish Community Center in 58. Which had held integrated activities, and the home of leading civil rights lawyer and city council member Z. Alexander Luby in 1960. I asked Phillips to follow a trajectory from this year's neo-Nazi marches in Nashville back to the unsolved bombings that are now the focus of a newly assigned cold case detective with the Nashville Police.
One of the reasons that I'm really excited about the mayor reopening these investigations is that the Nashville Police can do something now that Nashville Police in the 50s could not do, which is make a bunch of long distance calls. So one of the biggest impediments to solving these cases back in the day, and one that I, just because I have email, could easily overcome, is that I could contact Florida and see what records they had. I could easily email Birmingham and see what they had. And that's just not something that was really possible in the 1950s. So while everybody, throughout the South, they knew that there was this group, the Confederate Underground, because after they bombed something, they would call and take credit. So municipalities throughout the South wanted the FBI to step in because they're like, you have funding and you have the ability to do these kind of interstate investigations. And look, they're using the same name throughout the South for both these bombings of black institutions and bombings of Jewish institutions. So you figure out who they are and we'll stop them. And the FBI was repeatedly no, these are local matters. They're unconnected. They don't have anything to do with each other. And so they were just able to continue their activities. And, members of this network were even present in Birmingham in the week before the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. So, the implications of not catching them while they're in Nashville were enormous for the nation.
So let's get real specific. Of course, sure. The Birmingham bombing was 1963 in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the Hattie Cotton School in 1957 that was set to integrate. What happened?
Yes, right. So John Casper, who was a racist activist, had been in town all month basically fomenting discord. And racists throughout the South, like Asa Carter, for instance, and Bill Hendricks from down in Florida, had come up to help him. The FBI heard from an informant, hey, these guys have dynamite, they're building a bomb. And then they heard again from the informant, my friend has seen the dynamite. The FBI did not share this with the Nashville Police. So The day of school integration, protesters went to all the schools that they knew were integrating. No one knew ahead of time that Hetty Cotton was integrating because Patricia Watson's family didn't pre-register her. They just registered her the day of. So Hetty Cotton didn't have the same kinds of police presence that these other schools had. And that evening, when after the first day of school, when police were trying to figure out, you know, like, well, where do we need to be? What do we need to be keeping an eye on? They only went to the schools where there had been mild riots. I don't know how to better put that, demonstrations that day. And since there hadn't been big demonstrations at Hetty Cotton, they left it a sitting duck. So that night, at right about just after midnight, the school blew up. The whole East Wing was blown up. And then in the aftermath of that, one of the things that got me hooked on this, where I was like, whoa, this is much more complicated than I realized, because in the FBI records, they talked about, like, we have these witnesses, we are not sharing them with the Nashville police. And then in the FBI file, there's a memo outlining, like, yes, we had this information, here's when we had it, blah, blah, blah. And someone had crossed through September 10th, the day of the bombing, and backdated it so that it looked like they had informed the Nashville police before the bombing that they knew that there was dynamite in town and this bombing plot. So that's when I was like, well, clearly this is a bigger story than just, like, you know, racist blow up a school. Like, they're, you know, why is the FBI behaving this way? Why is the Nashville police behaving this way? And then as I'm going through the FBI file, towards the end of the file, I find a report that the FBI is hearing from an informant who did the bombing. And I'm like, wait, so they had a name, or two names actually, by the beginning of 1958, and yet these bombings are still unsolved. And then when you fast forward to the JCC, or the Jewish Community Center, in Nashville itself, that bombing is not really thought of as being one of these civil rights bombings. Like, people know about Hetty Cotton and they know about the Luby bombing, but they haven't really been viewing the JCC as part of that, even though after the JCC blew up, the bombers called the AP, the Tennessean, the Rabbi Silverman from the temple, and said, we have just blown up your center of integration, and next we're going after the judge who approved Nashville school desegregation. So these bombers tried to make it as clear as possible that the JCC bombing was related to school integration, but somehow that's kind of fallen out of the collective knowledge. But when I found that out, and I found that they called themselves the Confederate Underground, not only did that lead me to a bunch of Confederate Underground bombings throughout the South, Charlotte, Gastonia, Jacksonville, Miami, Birmingham, Atlanta, so on. I also found that so the Confederate Underground said, you know, we've just blown up your center of integration, next is Judge Miller, and then we're going to blow up the temple in Belmete. In 1981, a group calling itself the Confederate Vigilantes tried to blow up the temple. So I went to talk to the head of the Confederate Vigilantes, Gladys Gergenti, to ask her if the Confederate Vigilantes and the Confederate Underground were related. And apparently, weirdly enough, I was the first person to ever do that, even though she was extensively interviewed by the FBI and the police. So I spoke with the U.S. attorney who had prosecuted her. And again, this is just like a matter of technology and the difference, right? Because I was easily able to Google Gladys, and I was able to easily learn that she grew up here. But the U.S. attorney who tried her thought she was from Detroit, because that's where she and her second husband had lived for most of their married life. So he had never even thought to connect her to the bombings here, because as far as he knew, she didn't live here. So, you know, that again, like in many ways, there were difficult things, but it was much easier for me to investigate these crimes just because, like, I have Google, and police and the FBI back then didn't. And then the third bombing, of course, is the bombing of Z. Alexander Luby's home in April of 1960. This, to me, the other two bombings, I have a pretty good idea of who did them. This bombing was the most difficult to solve, and I don't think that I have it 100% solved, but it definitely left like the least clues. And yet he was a sitting city councilman, so he was an active U.S. politician who someone tried to assassinate. You would think that this would be something that people would want solved, just because they would want to know if they were also politicians, if they were in danger.
Betsy, I want to play a clip of the civil rights activist John Lewis, who would later serve 17 terms as a Georgia Congress member, has said the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were written, quote, with our blood. In a 1979 interview for the documentary They Loved You Madly, John Lewis spoke about that morning that you're describing right now, April 19th, 1960, and the bombing of the Nashville home of the civil rights lawyer, Z. Alexander Luby.
It was early one morning, about 6 o'clock. Z. Alexander Luby, who had been a strong supporter and defender of civil rights, a member of the city council, the first black member of the city council in the city of Nashville, he was a NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer, and had been the legal counsel for all of the students that had participated in the city and that brought some of the original school desegregation cases and worked with Thurgood Marshall. We heard that his house had been bombed, and all across the city, on the different college campuses, we had a similar reaction to call a meeting of the Nashville Central Committee. The Central Committee was the executive committee of the Nashville Student Nonviolent Movement. By, I would say, between 6:30 and 7 o'clock, we were meeting. Shortly after 7, we had sent the mayor a telegram saying to the mayor that we would have a march on City Hall. The mayor was Ben West, was the mayor's name, to protest the bombing of Trenton Luby's house. By noon, we had more than 5,000 students from Tennessee State, Fisk University, American Baptist Theological Seminary, Meharry, and Vanderbilt, and people from the community with a sense of righteous indignation.
John Lewis later became a Congress member representing Atlanta. When the march reached City Hall that day, activists confronted the mayor about the violence and asked if he believed it was morally wrong for the lunch counters in Nashville to be segregated. The mayor agreed it was wrong, and negotiations led 6 downtown stores to begin serving black customers at their lunch counters for the first time the following month. And John Lewis, this was his first, as you said, coming out of Nashville. He wasn't born in Nashville, but this was his first major action with the Nashville sit-ins of 1960. And in the middle of this, yet another, like your title, Dynamite Nashville, bombing of this attorney. So, Betsy, tell us about J.B. Stoner, a suspect in the Nashville bombings, perhaps best known as one of James Earl Ray's lawyers. James Earl Ray, the man who assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King. Talk about his connections.
Right. So, J.B. Stoner was a Chattanoogan who rechartered the Klan when he was in high school. He was also pen pals with like an actual Nazi, which is one of the reasons I don't like to use the term neo-Nazi, because there's no break, right? These are just Nazis. Stoner at the time I'm looking at, seems to have been operating as somewhat of a like terrorist consultant. So if you were a local Klan group that wanted to bomb a school or a church or whatever, rather than you having to go around practicing, you know, placing bombs or building bombs, which would have opened you up to potentially getting caught before you could hit your target, you could just call in Stoner and he would walk you through how to build a bomb. He had connections that would bring you in dynamite. If you didn't have somebody on your team who was willing to actually do the bombing, as long as you supplied a driver, he could supply a bomber. So I started looking, you know, just all of the places that he pops up. And at some point, and I think it is because of what he learned in Nashville helping with these bombings, he also then went to law school. So by the time you get into the 60s, what you see is that all the violence that J.B. Stoner is helping direct, if you got caught, then he could step in and represent you. So it was like a one-stop shop for evil.
And finally, I mean, it was in Tennessee, not in Nashville, but in Memphis, 8 years mm-hmm. later, when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, a target of the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover obviously despised him, targeted him. What kind of connections, as I mean, you talked about Stoner representing the assassin, but what kind of connections did you see leading up to that, that you could identify in your city of Nashville?
Right. Well, one of the things that, so J.B. Stoner was actually one of the first region-wide. There had been, like, local people wanted to kill King, who lived in the same towns as King. But J.B. Stoner and his friend Jack Brown, not to throw another name into the mix, but J.B. Stoner and Jack Brown were the first two, like, region-wide people who didn't have, like, a direct connection to King, who had plots to kill King. Stoner's plot was in 1958, and then Jack Brown told a friend in 1960 that he had been traveling from Chattanooga to Atlanta to try to figure out if he shot King, how could he get out of that neighborhood alive? So to see Stoner's name continue to pop up in these circles, and then, like, what I heard is that after King was killed in Memphis, that FBI informants were sitting in a room with Stoner, who was in Jackson, Mississippi at the time. And before the news had hit, the phone rang, Stoner picks it up, and he's like, oh, good, he's a good one now, a good N-word now, and then hung up. And then they heard the news that King had been killed. But the FBI's contention has always been that J.B. Stoner wasn't involved because he wasn't in Memphis. But one of the things that I found in my research is that Stoner, like, early on, he was directly involved with bombings, but very quickly, he came the week before, he set things up, and then he left town. So the fact that Stoner wasn't in town for, you know, in Memphis for the assassination means nothing about whether or not he was involved. So that was, you know, very shocking to me to realize, like, again, like, if these folks had been dealt with when they were in Nashville before they were getting really good at committing violence and getting away with it, the 60s would have just looked a lot different.
Betsy Phillips, historian and author of the new book, Dynamite Nashville, Unmasking the FBI, the KKK, and the Bombers Beyond Their Control. Her book prompted Nashville's mayor to now reopen a police investigation into the three civil rights era bombings she focuses on. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.